Welcome to the Dirty Inning. It is the season finale of the regular Major League Baseball season. Drinks are half price, clothes are halved off, and nobody's getting out alive. I am Justin Clue, formerly the head guy at The Good Fight, currently
unemployed,
a contributor, currently wandering the highways of Philadelphia, begging anyone just for that chance to get in their car and blog the night away. Now, currently a contributor to FanGraphs and Baseball Prospectus, and with me is Dr. Trevor Strunk.
Hello.
Dr. Trevor Strunk, it is the end of the baseball season, a bittersweet time on the calendar.
I guess. I will...
Moving along.
No, it is. And I want to tell the listeners, I mean, not every one of them saw your post. They should read it if they haven't. It's a good farewell post. You did a great job. It's the last nice thing I'm going to say about you today.
I appreciate
it. Yeah, it's just, like, it's weird for both of us. I wanted to say that, don't worry, Justin is not leaving the podcast. We're still going to be doing the podcast. Leaving The Good Fight does not mean leaving The Dirty Inning, at least according to what you said. Maybe no. I'll get phased out. I mean, that's kind of that's always kind of been on the table. And now that Justin has, like, media friends, it might happen. But, you know, I mean, we'll see.
Honestly, that's all I'm going to tell you is that we'll see. I don't know the future, but clearly we're not above making some adjustments. Improving the quality of the content is our primary goal here.
I hear Matt Vasgersian is looking for work.
Yeah, and we've been in touch, and I'm holding some really promising resumes, and his is one of them. So, you know, I appreciate your openness and your candor on this issue.
As the weakest possible link of any podcast I'm on, it's you know, refreshing to be able to say it on air.
I mean, you know, this hasn't been working ideally for some time.
Oh God, probably since episode one.
Most assuredly since episode one. The problem was building up enough of an audience that that people would be interested in replacing you. And mm-hmm. I've been interested in replacing you, again, since day one. But, you know, here we are with a brand new opportunity, road in front of us. Who knows where it takes us? Again, you, it will take away from here. But who knows what lies ahead for the rest of us?
Yeah. Oh, the sweet, sweet embrace of death. Justin, what's our game today?
Well, Trev, we're going to just sit here and dwell a bit on the final game of the baseball calendar. The Phillies, of course, in 2019
getting very excited.
Had theirs, and it was once again meaningless.
Trev, I really liked how they lost it, too.
Do you ever, to the worst team in baseball?
Yeah.
Do you ever, what's your take? Well, generally, we've had a lot of last games of the season for the Phillies since 2012. They've all been pretty much for essentially no reason. Obviously, you could write, well, hey, no, it's about fan morale. It's about appreciation. I mean,
truly, I would never write that. I would probably write that it was for draft positioning.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. The Phillies won't get a whole lot of good draft positioning out of this season. You know, they were just good enough to be horrifically average.
Yeah.
Bryce Harper, you know, he got a standing ovation in his final at bat. He gave a nice little speech to the fans. He said, I believe in this organization. I believe in this city, and we will reign again. And, you know, hey, I don't think anybody should be holding anything against Bryce Harper for this season. This certainly, you know, he might have had a slow start, but he certainly gave his all, I would say, and really improved on defense. But, I mean, I don't know. This just all just contributes to that bittersweetness that takes over in the final day of the season. It's not just, you know, that baseball's over, because it's not. Actually, the most entertaining and full month of baseball is still ahead of us. But
but we don't care.
Right, the Phillies are not going to be involved in that. And, you know, that's happened quite a bit over the past decade. Wow. But again, that's the indicator here that the passage of time has continued. We're once more at the end of a summer. Fall is right around the corner. And, you know, where did the time go? I mean, where do you find yourself at the end of this season or at the end of any season?
Where do I find myself?
Yeah, when you sit back and, I mean, do you not just sit down, look out the window, and have long periods of self-reflection? Just
about
in regards
passage of time. Yeah. Sometimes, yeah. You know, it actually, I would say I had it more when the Phillies were being successful. Because now when they're not, I kind of lose all of September. Because I mean, what was there to really focus on once we all decided they were going to lose? I mean, we all knew.
When you say you lose all of September, do you mean you do not recall? You just
I don't recall much of it. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
wake up on a highway kind of situation. Cars honking.
The doctor says I have brain lesions, but I like to say that I have
friends in my head.
Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. No, you know what I have? I have Phillies lesions.
Hmm. And that sounds better to you. That's a better.
Yeah.
That's,
okay. It's about the team, Justin, and about as I said, it's about the team, Justin.
Is that what you say when you like come out of it and your wife's driving very slowly behind you, screaming at you to get in the car and put your shirt back on?
Yeah.
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 So okay.
How about you? What are your reflections like?
Well, you know, I always go back to this one day that Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports and I used to attend Phillies games on the last day of the season. I would say it's sort of a regular tradition, but it really only happened maybe 3 years in a row. And it was three of the worst years of this terrible Phillies swing of things. And the one year it happened to be that we were sitting under this one of the roofs in K-Lot. We were tailgating, but we didn't even have a car. We just had a bag of beers. In my head, it was 40s, but I don't think we were.
You weren't that hardcore.
We weren't. Yeah, we weren't low enough to be drinking 40s at that point. But I managed to get a text from a friend of mine who said, you know, hey, my dad's company has this box suite right behind home plate at the Phillies game tonight. If you want to come down, they can't give these tickets away. And where I was like, I'm actually in the parking lot. So we got to go upstairs and watch. Like, and that was the, I don't know if you've ever heard the story, but this was the infamous game in which we were leaning out the front of a box suite at Citizens Bank Park, screaming up at Scott and Larry in the radio booth. They actually looked down and waved, and I'm sure had all sorts of wonderful things to say about us on the broadcast, but that's the kind of behavior. I mean, it's mostly empty stadium. I guess it's just that same sensation of like when all your roommates move out and you're just the last one there waiting to get picked up.
That's actually really, really a good way of saying it. Like it really is like, what am I doing here? What is this okay to be here? Like, should I feel happy or sad? I feel like I'm taking up time that I should be doing something else. Like, it's a very weird feeling.
Right. And like especially a game like the Phillies and Marlins, there's actually no reason for that game to be played. They're not like playing for sixth place or even, like you said, really jockeying for any significant draft position in the Phillies case. So like that game could have gotten rained out and we all would have been satisfied with 161, I think. So
yeah, my friend Matt texted me before the game. Or during the game. It wasn't even the last game. I think it was like two games ago. And his question to me, which a fair question, was, why are they still playing baseball? Well, it's a complicated answer.
That's the most horrifying part to explain to non-baseball fans is that, that it goes on forever.
Yeah, mistakes were made, let's just say.
Yeah, we could have gone about this in a better way. But yeah, I mean, that's the essence of what we're going to talk about today, Trev. The final game of the season. What does it mean? How do you feel? Especially when you're a team for whom it is actually the last game of the season. And in 1928, Trevor, on September 30th, our Philadelphia Phillies played the last game of their very, very terrible season. And as we discussed, Trevor, I mean, there was no reason for this game to happen. But then again, what regular season finales are ever necessary? It was played in front of a few hundred people. It was way too cold for baseball because the planet was still functioning normally, and it was September 30th.
Thank God we fixed that.
This game lasted a mere 85 minutes. Hardly worth your butt feeling the cold metal of a stadium bleacher beneath it. Wrote the Inquirer, there is no reason why the Robins and Phillies should not have ended the 1928 season in Greenland. In fact, they did just that to all practical purposes. Referring, of course, to the temperature and the lack of people who were interested in watching them play this final game. Yeah, this was one of the years where it was the Brooklyn Robins, not the Brooklyn Dodgers.
I mean, sure, why not? Mm-hmm.
Trev, the Robins scored 4 runs in the bottom of the first, and in doing so, sealed the fates of everyone at Ebbets Field.
I'm sorry, you misspoke. You meant Greenland Field.
Sorry. At the Air Force Base in the middle of Greenland in which this game took place.
What are we playing here, Skip? Shut up.
Because they don't want us over there no more. The Phillies would lose 5-1 with the offense generated in a real clusterfuck of a first inning, being enough to send everyone home for the winter, shaking their heads in disgust. So really, this game, it wasn't even the dirtiest of innings, but it happened on the last game of the season in a game that didn't need to happen. It happened to be all hinge on one of the filthiest, dumbest plays we'll read about or hear about on this podcast. The action came down to a few principal players who we will discuss after we set the scene. This game, of course, took place in Brooklyn at Ebbets Field, but the Phillies were coming from a Philadelphia in 1928 with a whole lot going on, frankly. just a few tidbits here just to start us off.
Please get. I have to hear it.
1928 Philadelphia. Somebody named Felton Bent bought an English bulldog for $5,000. Her name was Sesu, and she was a tri-international champion English bulldog. Trevor, do you think someone named Felton Bent is capable of anything other than paying thousands and thousands of dollars for a prized bulldog?
That seems
only thing on earth he was meant to do.
No, absolutely the only thing. I mean, Felton Bent, this is a person who, should not be. This is a person who has been tricked into buying the Brooklyn Bridge many times, because once he tells the person that he has bought it already, the person says, oh, well, you didn't read in the paper, the state reseized it and it actually went back. It's a whole paperwork thing, but I can fix that for you. he owns swampland, and he owns swamp insurance on the swampland he owns. he is a nightmare.
He still says daddy when he speaks to his father. He's 45 years old. His father has one of those giant funnels that he's got to speak into. He holds up to his ear.
Yeah, no, that's right. Get him.
Yeah, get
this guy.
Take him down. I'm going to get a nasty letter from the Bent family on very fancy stationery.
Excuse me.
How dare you? Our family has been breeding champion bulldogs for generations.
They actually just have a really, really lucrative bulldog breeding business off of this one thing. And they're like, well, joke's on you. It's actually pretty important that we did this.
There is a wall-sized portrait of Felton in our study. He is the one who started our fortune by making this deal. Pathetic.
Awful. Well, let's just wipe him off the earth. That's what I say.
Philadelphia was a place of balance at this point. So for every Felton Bent, there was a gun-wielding bandit working to the bourgeoisie down. 4 bandits, Trev, wearing handkerchiefs as masks, were speeding around North Philly around this time in what was called a, quote, high-powered automobile, robbing bakery wagons at gunpoint. So, yeah, my question...
A high-powered automobile, you say?
My question for you, then, is yes, of course, why a newspaper would bother to classify it as a high-powered automobile, and you, being a real car guy, could maybe explain... What sets a high-powered automobile apart from one that's just got, a regular engine that can go 100 miles an hour?
My guess is that there were no engines that could go 100 miles an hour then.
I think it's about tubes and tubing.
I think it's about Hemis.
Okay. Well, the Hemis travel through the tubes to the engine, where I believe there is a furious hamster running on a wheel.
The angriest hamster.
Yeah, like he's all jacked up on steroids and human growth hormones, and he's got little muscles, but he's putting his steps in, and that thing is just running so fast there's steam coming off of it, and that fuels the Hemis, and in turn, I guess gasoline plays a role here. I'm not quite clear on.
I'm listening.
I guess that's the explosive charges.
I would assume it, since it's 1921 Yeah. It is a car built on top of another car, like the like Wacky Races style. Because for a long period of time, that was considered the only way to make a car more powerful.
That's a good point. I guess Cole is playing an issue here as well.
Cole, what's she up to?
No, of course, I mean the filthy element is being shoveled into the back of the car.
It's a really weird thing to call Cole, but okay.
Solar winds.
Go off, I guess.
Also play a role here, and mm-hmm. you can only drive your cars during lightning storms when the electric strike is going to be able to provide the ignition.
Yeah, absolutely correct.
So this was really a daring crime for four bandits to take on. Again, robbing bakery wagons at gunpoint with handkerchiefs over their faces.
Is it dumb of me to ask what the point of robbing a bakery wagon is?
Well, they made off with a total of $575. So
pretty good for 1921 money, I gotta tell you.
I was going to say, I didn't bother to convert that based on inflation. Boy. But it sounds like quite a take. Got reported in the papers, you know?
Yeah, that's not nothing.
Yeah. Bakeries were pretty, you know, pretty prominent back then.
Was that just like where the money went?
I think, you know, Richard, they held at gunpoint a young Richard Q. Tasty Cake. And,
hey, Richie, how you doing?
Alfredo Amoroso.
No.
No.
Not him.
Yeah, all of them. All the ancestors of the brands we know today.
Oh, and love.
Urinating in their pants as emptied their cash bins into the, I can only assume, burlap sacks with dollar signs on them held by these wanted criminals.
And just a souped up hearse. Yeah. It was painted puce.
Well, there was also, and this was interesting, there was also a...
really excited about what's going to come next since you added, this is interesting.
Well, it's interesting because what we just talked about was that a rampage of four bandits making off with all these bakers' money. But actually, this was a time where the city was trying to institute a safety drive to keep the people of Philadelphia safe. Or at least informed as to the benefits of safer behaviors. Uh-huh. This is what we got. This is from the Inquirer.
Kind of safe behaviors are we talking about? Is this like a sex thing or?
No, it's well. Let me just read it to you. It says the headline just reads "Safety Drive Opens," and this is again from the Inquirer on September 30th, 1928. Every section of Philadelphia will be reached during this week by the Citizens Safety Committee of the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce with its safety caravan, that is in quotes, safety caravan, equipped with a new broadcasting system which will herald its safety message to people everywhere.
Oh, God.
6 seconds for safety will be the text of the message that will be broadcast by Fred W. Johnson, managing editor of the Safety Committee, by police traffic officials, and by other experts in their effort to arouse the public to highway hazards. So, correct me if I'm wrong, is this not a guy driving around in a car, like, speaking into a microphone, going,
yeah, this is like,
everyone be safe out there.
This is just the Blues Brothers, right? Like, this is just the Blues Brothers in reverse.
Hey, over there, are you being safe? Yeah. Okay.
It's nighttime. And we are buckled up and using the appropriate lights on our car so that we don't blind other drivers.
Right.
Yeah.
It's strange, right?
It's weird. Like,
it's a very 20s idea, I think.
Well, I mean, yeah, because it has that kind of...
They're just like, we haven't had any ideas yet, so here's one.
It's that great 20s optimism of like, well, the reason people aren't doing this is because they're not hearing it. And now, of course, with the internet, we're like, oh, no, that's not the reason.
Oh, gosh. Oh, boy. No, we were all aware of what we were doing.
Everyone knew. It's just they're just so terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just to give you an idea of what was in the mind, or in this case, the stomach of the everyman of Philadelphia, Philadelphia Inquirer was running dinner recipes of the day.
Gross. I'm sure they're all terrible.
Listen to this. It is terrible.
I wasn't so joking. I'm sure they're horrible.
The dinner suggestion of the day in the Inquirer was bean loaf with tomato sauce.
Oh, no.
Bavarian cabbage and apple tapioca for dessert.
What
the hell
about?
Is that? What is bean loaf? I mean, I can guess what it is, but why? We don't do that anymore. Where is that?
Could bean loaf
sounds awful.
Could bean loaf be like a vegan alternative to meatloaf, do you think?
You think I mean, yeah, I do. But I think that's how you would market it today. Back then, they're just saying, like, it's dinner. Dad's home from work. It's a bean loaf night.
Time for some beef loaf.
Yeah.
Time to eat your bean loaf.
Honey, I took a pile of beans and with my bare hands just molded them into a nice loaf, dense with beanage. And then I cooked that, and it's seeping mess, and it's solidified somewhat. And if that's not enough for you, cabbage is also here. And don't forget to save room for dessert. Trev, what is tapioca? Is it like a pudding?
Tapioca? Tapioca's like those, like, you ever have like a bubble tea?
Okay. That's
it's those things. It's like those little balls.
Okay.
I think.
I mean, not worth it. You know, not like I'd be like, well, I guess I'll stomach this bean loaf and cabbage just to get to the tapioca.
Were people, this is a really rude question, but were people already poor? I know they got real poor in the Depression, but were they poor like now?
I mean, I'm sure there were poor people in Philadelphia, and I think everybody read the newspaper. Like it was pretty much how you learned things at this point.
I mean, sure, yeah, okay.
It was like a little slice of internet dropped on your front stoop every morning. So, you know, they're gonna they're gonna offer you recipes that anybody can make, probably. Prohibition? Don't forget.
So you think they're just drunk?
No, I'm saying...
I mean, a drunk off of sobriety.
Yeah, nice. Good, nice. Good. Perfect. Save. Oh, that means exactly the same thing. Yeah, nailed it. Yeah, no, I'm saying that not only were, yes, they're definitely poor people leading up to the
Great Depression. Well, I thought it was still the roaring 20s year, when everyone was, like, extremely rich.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there was a bit... I'm sure there was... why do you think there was only one kind of person?
There was later...
There were certainly rich and poor people in 1928 in Philadelphia. Yes, that is true. There were also, Trev, a group called the Veteran Wheelman's Association of Philadelphia. Now, I know what you're thinking. And you're thinking, is the driver of a heist gang of criminals, like, are a bunch of those guys getting together, and do they have their own association at this point? And the answer is no.
Oh, darn it.
You fool. It's actually an association of old men.
It'd be so nice
men,
if they unionized.
Of old men who liked bicycles.
Oh, that's wholesome.
Yeah, they had a dinner. They had a big dinner. It was a group of old timers who were, I guess, among the city's first bicyclists. Because, you know, if you're 80 years old in 1928, there's a chance you saw something like the first bicycle, which was, of course, called the Velocipede. At that time.
You knew that from The Simpsons, I'm sure.
Well, I knew it from The Simpsons, but also because I had to look up what a bone shaker was. Are you familiar with this term?
I'm going to say no.
Go ahead, guess.
I'm going to guess it's the kind of bike that shakes your bones when you drive it.
Now, shut up. Yeah, that's it. It's what they call the original...
You kind of gave me some hints there.
The original velocipedes. They were made of wood.
The original velocipedes.
Grab a bone shaker today. The original velocipede.
Oh, look at you and your fancy velocipede that doesn't shake your bones out.
What an appealing marketing statement. I'm sold. yeah, they were called riding what they called bone shakers, which were original bikes that were made of wood and famously rattled you to your very core while you were riding it. And yeah, there were 200 of these wheelmen in this association. They all got together to have a dinner, and then they watched stunts on bikes that were labeled as Ordinaries, Stars, and Tandems.
That is cool to get together with your buddies and watch stunts.
Right. They're like, we're going to have dinner, and we're going to watch these Boy Scouts ride around on bicycles, and that'll just be something that happens in 1928. And the newspaper will spend, like 800 words covering this this event. It will be a full column on the side of one of the pages. And there's, like, other stuff going on. There's, like, important stuff going on in the world and in the city. But these old men and their bicycles... You know, we're going to be, it's hot to trot. This is like a page 7 story.
I'm into it, honestly. Just like, let them have their moment.
Yeah. Well, they had it. Also having his moment at this time,
excited.
man named Dr. A. Ray Petty, a pastor at Grace Baptist Temple. He demanded answers from a police corruption investigation that was going on at the time. He was at the pulpit while giving a sermon at his church. He was the story I read was about him giving this sermon where he was like, "We need answers from this police corruption investigation. I suspect it's gone higher than just the few regular patrolmen that have surfaced as corrupt. We think,
man,
it goes
weird.
Even
the
higher.
Police were kind of corrupt.
If the DA doesn't give us answers, we will keep asking. And at first I was like, all right, I wonder what they're up to. Like this guy's really giving them the business. Of course, then I was reminded, oh, it is prohibition. And what they're guilty of is allowing liquor into the city despite prohibition laws.
Oh.
So this pastor was upset that liquor was still getting into the city.
Oh,
and
man.
This, he complained.
What a square.
What a nerd. Get out of here. We got a drink. It's cool.
Drinking is cool.
So he also, he complained about this for a while, but the nature of the sermon led him to ask, if Philadelphia, they were at a crossroads and it was time to decide, was Philadelphia Christian or was it pagan?
Ooh, cool. What did they
pick? Pivotal moment. Well, they took a straw poll and, hail Satan. This is from the Inquirer's coverage of this man's nonsensical ramblings. The only reason that we have thousands of speakeasies in this city and thousands of other places where liquor is sold illegally is because too many are pagans with only the desire for drink as their chief aim in life.
Is that what pagans really liked? I thought pagans were really interested in appeasing nature spirits and stuff.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I think he's playing pretty fast and loose with the term pagan here. I think pagan just means follower of Satan, and that, of course, you can lump any of the stuff you don't like as a pastor into. Pagans? I don't like it that airplanes fly over my house and the devil is sending them just to rob me of my sleep. Pagans, all of them. Planes.
Do you think that? Do you think that he knew about the biker gang?
Oh, the kindly old men watching Boy Scouts perform bicycle?
No, although that would be funny. No, I'm thinking of the biker gang, the Pagans.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, I do not think he was.
He went back in time and learned forward in time and learned about the Pagans?
Interesting question. Absolutely not.
I think he'd be really upset.
Well, of course. I think he'd be upset by a lot of things he'd learn coming forward in time.
More pagans?
And the Bent family is still doing well? Oh.
I thought that dog would be the end of them. No way.
Well, that's what was going on in Philadelphia. That's the city the Phillies called home. That's the city they left behind to play their final game of the season in Brooklyn in 1928. And we'll get to what happened in that game right after this first commercial break. Trevor Burt Schotten was the Phillies manager in 1928.
Please don't say guy? To me that word.
You know what's going on with this guy? You
no.
Hear about this guy?
I don't know anything about Burt Schotten.
Well, this was a time of rookies getting their chance, and the Phillies manager was one of them. The 43-year-old would manage the Phillies from 1928 to 1933, losing 108 games heading into this one on September 30th, 1928, and ending the season, having lost 109.
No!
he'd get the team all the way up to 78 wins in 1932, but leave the Phillies organization after 1933. Eventually, he'd win two NL pennants with Brooklyn, the team he was facing on September 30th, 1928. Schotten had showed up from managing Syracuse in the International League and started making changes to the Phillies immediately. He cut first baseman Bill Kelly. He cut our favorite, Heinie Sands.
No!
He traded for Don Hurst and Virgil Davis from the Cardinals. Most importantly, he decided to acquire the most important asset of all, brain powers.
Oh, boy. It sounds like someone else I know.
Yeah, I was. We're gonna get to that, and it's gonna get worse.
Uh-oh.
Schotten subscribed to the idea of psychology, or as the Brooklyn Daily Eagle put it, Schotten belongs to the new school of managers who study their men as well as the game.
So you can see where this is sexy. Going.
One of his efforts in 1929 was to force pitcher Les Sweetland to learn how to get the ball over the plate.
How to get more Sweetland.
He put him in a game and instructed his coaches to leave him in the game no matter what happened next. Sweetland, who'd led all of baseball and hit batsmen the previous year with 15.
Oh, no.
15. Walked the first five batters he faced.
Oh, so he believed in psychology but had no idea how to actually use it.
Well, I think it depends on what you... Again, we're using words like pagan and psychology in 1928.
Pretty loosely. Pretty loosely.
Yeah. It's a term that means he's thinking... Yeah, he's thinking about something, two things at once, essentially, is what they're saying.
Psychology just means the brain exists.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I think that's a much better way to put it. So he walks the first five batters he'd faced and shot and didn't care. Sweetland was going to learn control, or nightfall would arrive and the game would be called. It was one or the other.
Oh, God.
So even Shotten deemed that particular experiment a failure. But Sweetland did go on to shut out the Robins later that season and amass a 5.11 ERA in 43 games. So he did kind of learn his control. But Shotten's psychology pretty much boiled down to, quote...
I don't like this guy at all.
Pretty much boiled down to force people to keep suffering until they get better at the thing that causes their suffering. So that's what I got from the reading I did on his various experiments. It was basically like, I'm not giving up on you. So imagine you're a player and you suck. That's probably pretty easy for you and me to imagine.
Yeah. Thanks for including both of us there.
You got it. Not athletes hosting this.
No.
Imagine going out there in one of the games you played in as a young athlete, and you knew it was going to be as big of a challenge as the last game was, but you also had an assurance that no matter what happened, you weren't going to be punished. You know, you weren't going to be taken out of the game. Nothing was going to change based on what you did. Doesn't that at least take a little bit of the pressure off?
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, you at least get to, I would say maybe you get a chance to just try stuff. Like maybe you just get a chance to get outside of your head and be like, okay, I'm just going to give it a try. I'm going to try and do this one thing that I don't think is going to work, but maybe it will, kind of thing. You know, like I could see that being good.
Right. And like that's there's a positive to be gained from that. And I think essentially that's what he was trying to do. It was like throwing, you want to teach your kid how to swim, throw him off the dock. It's not something that's going to gain you any points with the victim of your experiments, but it may in essence force them to learn the thing that they're trying to learn.
If you've ever seen Friday the 13th 8, it could also make Jason Voorhees come back to life.
Just a real stellar contribution to the
hey, you're welcome.
There. That was actually perfect. Yes. If anyone listening has seen Friday the 13th Part 8, Trevor has the reference for you. So
you should go see it. It's good.
Go see it. Like what? I can go somewhere and watch that movie that's being played? Come on. Where is that being played? Oh, you should go to like my friend's house.
It was on Netflix for a while.
I can. Well, why would I go anywhere and watch it then? It would just be at my home.
Just like go to your couch.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, technically, that's correct. All right. So look, I don't know if what Bert Shotten was up to was psychology in general. It kind of sounds like how they talk about Gabe Kapler and analytics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kapler's not using correct me if I'm wrong, there's a lot of branches to the analytics tree. He's using the one that he and the Phillies have chosen to use. I don't know if you read that Athletic piece about by Matt Gelb about the Chris Young, the pitching coach, and his struggles this season.
Yeah, he sucks.
It mentions that he and Kapler had this algorithm that produced a number between 0 and 100 that determined whether or not, I think, I could be wrong going this from memory, that determined whether or not a pitcher should stay in the game.
Great.
At a certain point.
Sounds like a good thing to have.
I don't know if every team operates, you know, their analytics in that same vein, but psychology is the same way. You know, you can't just say, oh, he subscribes to psychology because he forces people to do things that they suck at. Like,
yeah, I like the idea that that would be something you could imagine being psychology. And then you look at someone like, you know, Roy Halladay's, sports psychologist who got him out of his own head and made him better at playing baseball.
I mean, that's like, honestly,
that's psychology too.
When we talk about mental health skills in baseball players, from what I've read, it's just differently phrased versions of getting players out of their own head. Like different ways of saying basically the idea, instead of don't think of a white horse, you say think of a black horse.
Right. Right.
Like that's it. I mean, I'm not saying that's it, like, that's it. But like that's essentially the philosophy I've seen him play most times. This is not that.
This is way different and probably much less effective.
So I'm not sure if that qualifies as psychology, but whatever. He did it to Sweetland. He did it to Lefty O'Doul, who couldn't hit lefties, but shot and acquired him via trade anyway and left him in games regardless of what pitcher they were facing. In 1928, Lefty O'Doul hit .211 versus left-handed pitchers. In 1929, Trev, hold on to your freaking butt. He hit .348 against them.
Whoa.
You want to talk about whether or not this guy got results?
That's incredible. Are there any failure stories?
I mean, you know, I don't think the Les Sweetland story really counts as a success.
You don't?
No, I do not. O'Doul finished his career with a .296 batting average and a .791 OPS versus lefties, over 60 points lower than his numbers against righties, but still, clearly he could hit them, you know?
Yeah, I mean...
Do we thank Bert Schotten for that? Don't know.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Bert Schotten also forced Chuck Klein to face his fear of forkballers as well. Schotten shoved him out there whenever he pleased, and in Klein's first at bat as a rookie, he was pinch hitting against Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Oh,
the manager of the new Phillies.
The says, new Phillies sounds like it's like new Coke or something.
Oh, we're gonna get to that. The manager of the new Phillies thinks the way to learn to do a thing is to do it, wrote Harold C. Burr.
What?
Which is pretty much what we said. The way to learn to do a thing is to do it.
The way to learn to do a thing. Yeah, I guess.
It's a lot of prepositional phrases, but it's, you know, technically that is what he thought. He was like, oh, you don't know how to hit forkballers? Get in there and hit this forkballer. I can't. Well, you will, or, you know, that's it.
Or you're benched.
I mean, you know, it's one or the other. But yeah, that's right. The new Phillies. Schotten was putting forth new ideas, and for that reason, they started calling his team the New Phillies with a capital N.
Hmm.
They are called the New Phillies, wrote the Brooklyn Eagle, to differentiate them from the old, just as daylight is differentiated from the dark.
Mm.
I mean, again, we see parallels everywhere. Baseball is a terrifying, cyclical, up and down.
Yeah, it's a nightmare sport. Themselves.
Literally a nightmare. This is one of those moments where you're like, this, it's not even trying to hide the fact that it's a repeating nightmare.
Yeah.
The new Philly. I mean, we had the new Phillies maybe last year, but definitely this year.
Yeah. When everyone's like, oh, it's not your dad's Phillies anymore. They're good now.
Yeah. And you're talking to like I guess a 10-year-old, someone born in 2008, a World Series baby from 2008 is 10 years old.
I don't want to think about a World Series baby. That's gross.
The passage of time. Now it's playing a prominent. What a fun theme in this episode about the last game of the season.
I don't know if it's as fun as you are laying it out to be. I think maybe some. I mean, I think a lot of people who listen to this are kind of old.
We'll all die someday. We're having some fun. The Phillies needed pitching was the problem, Trev. They were almost entirely missing it. Sound familiar? By 1929, Schotten would acquire a few promising arms, but at one point, when listing them to a reporter, he couldn't even remember one of their names. Still, though, these Phillies defined themselves by being scrappy and chatty and typically beaten. This is from... This is from an article, and I think it's the Brooklyn Eagle. The new Phillies started hustling back in April and are still on the move. They may be beaten, but their heads are always up. Their tongues noisy.
Ew.
What?
That's awful.
Caught me off guard. Manager Bert Schotten has all the time he will need to build up a winner. He has just signed an ironclad contract that doesn't expire until 1932. Already he has rid the team of the old last place complex, and within the next 3 years, all the mental hazards will have gone. The Athletics had better keep on winning to bask in the continued patronage of Father Penn's grandchildren. The new Phillies are coming. It's really good.
And then what happened?
Teams in this city. So good. Can you imagine if there were still two teams in Philadelphia?
I mean, yes, I kind of imagine it. It's
and,
a
and
nightmare.
And one of them was the A's, who led the Moneyball charge, like, you know, 10 years ago and never won the World Series.
Oh, it'd be so good.
And then the Phillies were like, oh, 10 years later, huh? Let's see what this is all about. Oh, no, we suck.
Oh, no. And in 2008, like, some doddering weirdo is like, hey, I'll take over the team. I'm just going to get all the good players. And goes to, like, two straight World Series.
Well, this 1928 season was the worst of Shotten's years here. When he left in 1933, he'd inadvertently started a stretch from 33 to 1948 in which the Phillies would never have a losing season.
Oh.
Wait a second.
I was going to say, never have that doesn't sound
winning
right.
Season? I think it's winning season. Yeah. This was cited
that's
in,
worse.
In an this was cited in an extremely dramatic column by Kevin Roberts in the Inquirer in 2007, when the team was approaching that 10,000 losses benchmark.
Oh yeah, that was a time.
He attempted to make the argument, Roberts did, that people should be disgusted by this, and no one should be embracing it or celebrating it, and that they should demand better.
No one should have fun. No one should ever enjoy anything. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you remember that it was
people were so serious about that.
It was kind of but it was in some ways, I think in some cases it was a carnival atmosphere. Like people were like, look, you did sense that the team was a little better, you know, the Aaron Rowand catch and Chase Utley and like the young core was showing up and everything. And, you know, that was exciting. And it was like, yeah, we're about to lose the most of any franchise in sports history. We got to own it. Or people are just going
to
own us.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Like, what are you hoping to get if you're just like, well, you know what? Like, I'm not going to celebrate being the losingest franchise in sports history. I'm gonna get mad about it, and then everyone who hates my team is going to understand that I'm serious. Like, can you imagine being like some Mets fan or some Braves fan being like, hey, good job winning, losing 1,000, or good job losing 10,000 games, and you're like, actually, that makes me really angry. I hate when you say that. Like, oh,
damn!
I won't say it anymore. I'm really sorry.
That information that's always just sitting out there, readily available for you to use against me. Yeah, that drives me crazy. So definitely don't say it again, or I'll go nuts. Thanks.
Like, are you kidding me? Like what? So stupid.
Yeah. So in his column, Roberts. I mean, like, look, I get what he's saying. It's just like,
I don't.
Can we have some dignity, please? Like, we should demand better. And you know what? At this point, they hadn't won the World Series. They hadn't been to the playoffs since 1993. I get wanting better. That is, it's a fair point. But he's just so extra about it.
Yeah.
So let me just read you a snippet here.
I'm excited.
Do you see anyone here having fun? Sometime soon, the Phillies will lose their 10,000th game, which is a testament to the franchise's longevity and to the fact that the Phillies have stunk so often. Hmm. And occasionally, someone will try to have fun with it, as if the Phillies should celebrate this milestone. A parade, maybe, or some kind of ceremony, or a giveaway at the ballpark. That's absolutely asinine. There is nothing to celebrate, and no occasion to mark. It's unfair to people here. And no, we're not talking about being unfair to the Phillies. You lose 10,000 games, people can make fun of you. That's how it works.
Man.
First of all, the Phillies of 2007 didn't lose 10,000 games.
First of all, friend, secondly, that can't even happen.
Secondly, I was a little floored by this. Secondly, it's kind of like these writers. I know the columnists are different than the beat writers, and the columnists are the ones who will occasionally claim to speak for the fans or something. I don't know.
And
but
get
like,
extra.
It's just if you're gonna, I don't know. I guess my point is objectivity. How much do you expect from a columnist as far as objectivity?
I mean, I expect a little. I know that they have to do a thing where they're like, where they set out some sort of, I don't know, where they do some sort of thing where they're like, oh gosh, you know, like, here's my, like, my moron of the week, or like, here's what I'm furious about this week. Like, I get that that's the form, like, fine, but like, I don't know, I expect them to at least have a little bit of shame. Just a little shame.
You're gonna not have a good time reading sports coverage.
I know. I don't ever read it because I just expect either. I expect the smallest amount of shame, not even a lot of shame.
Yeah. No. That's fair. Well, Schotten, you know, Bert Schotten was only responsible for 549 of those 10,000 losses, and 109 of them came in 1928.
549 is about 5% of it. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Only one of them came on September 30th, the day he decided to start rookie Martin Walker for the Phillies.
Okay.
Yes, the Phillies' starting pitcher on September 30th, 1928 was Martin Walker. Walker, along with... I'm sorry, this is my favorite part of this episode.
I'm like, really, I love... Can I say just, I mean, it's the last episode of this season. Not that we're going to stop doing it, because we end up doing these shows not during the season too, but I do love when... something tickles you and you get to the best part of the episode, because you always get like, it's always really obvious that you're there.
This sucks. And now it's built up so much that it's my favorite part, but it's not good enough to be.
That's okay.
So Walker, was reportedly plucked straight out of the Philadelphia sandlots, according to the Inquirer. And when that happened, they also got, they also found a young pitcher pitching nearby named Bill Durham, which sounds like an off-brand Bull Durham to me, which is so like on-brand for the Phillies. And I'm just picturing a movie poster of him, like a Philadelphia-themed piece of shit B-movie called Bill Durham, which they're expecting you not to notice the ripoff, but
say anything.
And he's so bad.
Bill Durham.
He's just terrible.
Double feature of Bill Durham and the sure thing, or like the easy goer instead of the nat. I'm trying to think of something other than the natural. But...
yeah. Oh my God. Bill
so Durham. Good.
You know, the kid with the arm that everyone could hit, and then he left.
The field of thinkings.
Field of nightly envisionments. This is the best part of any episode we've ever done. So
people are cracking up in their car. We're causing accidents across the Delaware Valley.
I can only hope our highest hope for this podcast is that we have caused multiple car accidents.
We just hurt people. We just want to hurt people. Is that too much to ask?
Martin Walker's full name was Martin Van Buren Walker, but he went by Buddy.
Awesome.
Or Bud.
Very cool to name your kid after a president just because they have the first name of that president.
I mean... like I think back then the office carried a little more weight behind it. It's like, oh, Martin Van Buren, are any relation to the president? No. Oh, still though, very impressive.
And now it's like, oh, Martin Van Buren, like the Seinfeld episode, funny.
Isn't he on the Simpsons? I guess that sucks. He went by Buddy or Bud, as about half the male population did in the 20s.
Sure.
I also saw him referred to as Red once, but that might have been because somebody misheard Bud, and I actually deeply
did
think
he have
that
red
this
hair?
What happened. I had no indication of that.
Only black and white photos, sure.
Right. So he was a side armor who had built his reputation by word of mouth, neighborhood by neighborhood in Philadelphia, which is probably the coolest way to get a reputation, frankly.
It is pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of being a side armor that happens to. That's
side
cool.
armor on a Philadelphia sandlot. Next thing you know, pitching for the Phillies, last day of the season.
That's neat.
Mm-hmm. On September 30th, 1928, Walker would make his first start as a big leaguer. He would also make his worst start as a major leaguer. He would also make his best start as a major leaguer, as this was his last start as a major leaguer and his only start as a major leaguer. He faced 5 batters. He would record no outs. He would amass a game score of 31. Ooh. He would depart baseball entirely. Well, not entirely. He would depart major league baseball entirely with an ERA of infinity. In total, his on-field
I love when
career,
that happens. His, so his good.
Entire, entire on-field big league career lasted a total of 10 minutes by the Yankees count.
Wow.
And according to their beat writer, Walker, quote, spent the rest of the afternoon draping himself around the gas heater in the clubhouse.
Oh, my God.
The New York Daily News
so
wrote
dark.
I actually, this was a quality line. The New York Daily News wrote that Walker lived up to his name by issuing three
rocks.
Free passes in the first and only inning he pitched. Of his performance and the game itself, they would write, the last vestige of the 1928 season was hilariously laid to rest yesterday.
Sounds like we're writing these.
Yeah. It was considered of note that the Robins win allowed them to finish above 500. Like, that was a big deal for them.
Oh, boy.
The Phillies would finish, as stated, at 43-109.
That's so bad.
They were 51 games out of first place. Oh. The Robins were a mere 17.5 games behind the NL champion Cardinals, finishing third to last. The Phillies would drop Martin Walker in May 1929 without, according to Baseball Reference, without ever letting him pitch again. He would be unceremoniously let go at the same time as Bert Schotten was apparently put on bed rest for influenza.
Oh, for and what did the coach decide to do? The manager just pushed the Bert Schotten is the manager or the pitcher?
Bert Schotten's the manager.
I lost
Martin
track.
Walker's the
yeah,
pitcher.
Sorry, yeah, sorry. No, I thought he was the other pitcher.
I have mentioned two names. I get why you'd get confused.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, I was thinking of the other people you talked about earlier. Did Bert Schotten use his psychology on himself and just, like, pump more influenza into his body in order to try and give
more, inject more. It's the only way. I will become the flu, therefore I will defeat it. Yes, he was 100%. He was more flu than man at that point. Anyway, he's dead.
any relation? Is it because of the flu or?
No, I have no idea.
You just think? I mean, just because he's from like a million years ago.
I mean, do you want to like look up how he died right now?
It's like a classic. Yes.
I feel like we could probably find.
All right, all right.
Yeah,
Bert.
He died July 29th, 1962. He was 77 years old. He died from a heart attack during the All-Star break in 1962.
Yeah, usually I've just get kind of bored during the All-Star break.
Oh, fun fact that I'll add, having looked this up. He was apparently, according to the National Baseball Hall of Fame, the last manager to wear street clothes while managing. Mm-hmm.
Listen to this. On the eve of the 1947 season, this is from Wikipedia, Schotten received a telegram from Branch Rickey. It read, be in Brooklyn in the morning, call nobody, see no one. Flying immediately from his Florida home, Schotten was ushered into Ricky's presence. Leo DeRocher, the Dodgers manager, had been suspended for the entire 1947 campaign for, quote, conduct detrimental for baseball. In a search for a temporary replacement, Ricky had been rebuffed by New York Yankees manager Joe McCarthy. Not that Joe McCarthy, I guess. And two of DeRocher's coaches. So he pleaded with him to take over the Dodgers for the remainder of the season. And so he did.
Wow.
He took the reins on April 18th, still in street clothes. That's just what you read. But yeah, I love the phrase, be in Brooklyn in the morning, call nobody, see no one. Ooh. Okay.
See no one. Well, I looked up and saw a guy from the train window. We didn't make eye contact, but per your instructions, I've gotten on a train home.
I am sorry. Please forgive me.
I still want the job for what it's worth. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was the beginning and end of Martin Walker, and the Phillies had we're going to talk about another Phillies pitcher during this terrible day, this
Ooh.
Season finale of 1928, right after we get back from this commercial break. Well, Trevor, Martin Walker was out as the Phillies starter on September 30th, 1928, their last game of a miserable season. Bert Schotten, the manager, was in the dugout trying to work his psychological magic on the players around him, despite them only having 43 wins on the season and about to suffer their 109th loss.
And hey, why not?
So,
I mean, you got to try something.
He pulls his rookie starter, Martin Walker, after the first five batters.
And then says, never show your face at baseball again.
Big league baseball days are over for Martin Walker with that trick of the mound. John Milligan enters the game as the next Phillies pitcher. When Walker left, Bert Schotten hands the ball to his reliever Milligan, who pitched the rest of the entire game.
Wow.
Which is to say, he pitched 9 innings, since Walker again recorded no outs. So
what? That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Yes.
I mean, did he do well?
I don't know. That's it. That's the end of the episode.
Wait, no, come on.
Get out of here. Milligan was one of two lefties Schotten had just acquired, the other being Walker. And he was probably like, well, that one didn't work. Let's see what this thing can do.
Let's see what this idiot can do.
Milligan, whose career started in 1928 as well, had been sold to the team by Syracuse of the New York Penn League for $7,000. He had pitched before this game on September 30th in 12 other appearances, making 7 starts. He doesn't get the start, though, right? Even though the pitcher before him started and recorded no outs, like he never existed?
Weird. So he doesn't get the start.
Right? He doesn't.
No, he didn't start the game.
Right.
You get the start when you actually start the game. That's right.
It's just an interesting question because Martin Walker gets the start, but technically pitches no innings. That's all.
Yeah, that's really weird. That's not common, is it?
It can't be common, but I bet something like that happened this year. There's enough shitty pitchers out there.
I mean, that's true. There are a lot of really bad pitchers. And I mean, I know there's a ton of pitchers with infinity ERAs.
But I'll bet that it's very rare. That's like a Jason Stark tweet.
Yeah,
A pitcher comes in, starts the game, records no outs, is relieved, and that pitcher pitches the rest of the game.
Yeah, it does sound like a Jason Stark tweet. And then he'd be like, which pitcher was it? And then we'd all guess, mm-hmm. and he'd be like, actually, it was Jason Vargas. Or like, actually, it was...
Jason Vargas today. What game were you watching? You are all idiots.
It's Austin Bibbitts Dirks. Gotcha with
you
that
You guys
one.
Didn't get Bibbitts Dirks? Come on, are you baseball fans or not? John Milligan, he showed up briefly for the Phillies from 1929 to 1930, and then... he would come back and pitch in 2 games for the Washington Senators in 1934 as well.
Hmm.
He was 24 years old in 1928, making his debut on August 11th against the Giants. He was beaten 4-0 as part of a homestand in which the Giants would go 15-4.
Yikes!
His next appearance was a pair of frames at the tail end of a doubleheader sweep of the Phillies at the hand of the Pirates. He made another appearance in another doubleheader sweep, this time against the Cardinals, when he made a start and got the loss because his defense couldn't hold it together. Heine Sand muffed a grounder at short in the third, and later in the inning, Don Hurst couldn't handle a pickoff throw from Milligan. That was in mid-September, offered a little bit of foreshadowing. By the time this team limped and sputtered into the regular season finale...
Excited to hear about this.
The Phillies had lost 12 games in a row leading up to this game and would lose 15 of their last 16. That wasn't even their worst stretch of the year.
Seriously?
They would go 3-22 in May.
Oh, no. That's bad.
It's no wonder Schotten wanted to rebrand them as the new Phillies. By this point, the name Phillies was probably too tame, which is why today we call them the... Oh.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Oh, gosh. Not good. That's bad.
So Walker starts in the first. He walks Brooklyn's leadoff hitter, Bill Gilbert. And the next one, Harvey Hendrick, tried to lay down a sack bunt. And then, chaos. Pinky Whitney was playing third that day for the Phillies. He'd finish 18th in MVP balloting in 1928, but also finish with a defensive war in the negatives. He raced in from his position to field the bunt and probably should have just held on to the ball as Hendrick raced down the line. But instead of gloving it, Whitney tried a throw to first, which went absolutely batshit wild. Don Hurst playing first, was able to track the ball down as the runners turned on the gas. And now he and Whitney reversed the routine with Hurst firing an ill-conceived and ill-executed throw across the diamond back to third base, which, yes, had exactly the same result. Another batshit crazy throw that skipped away from Whitney and allowed a run to score.
This sounds
and
brutal.
Honestly, that set the tone for the rest of Walker's career, which was, again, like 3 or 4 more batters. Shaken, Walker easily walked the next batter, Max West, which set up a 2-run triple for Rube Bresler. Del Bissonette.
Drew Bressler.
Del Bissonetti. Bissonetti. I should figure this out before we record. Singled in Bressler.
And never figure it out.
The score was 4-0, and Martin Walker's career came to an end.
God.
But the game didn't.
Uh-oh. No. don't tell me that.
No. That was Trev, what could have kept you in your seat after that first inning on a day like the one they described, where it's cold, it's deeply unpleasant, it's raining a little bit, and you watched like a little league series of miscues in the first inning?
I mean, maybe they promised me $100 if I stayed at the end of the game.
Okay. Yeah,
that would do it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. All right. I don't have to work for the next 3 to 4 decades. This is great. I don't know. I don't understand inflation. I assume all money is more valuable at all times throughout history.
Yeah.
The Phillies were actually supposed to play a doubleheader on this last day of the season.
No,
but
no. Did they cancel
It rained, so they just said, fuck it.
I mean, why not? Don't make people sit through that. They're your fans.
Goodbye till next year, read the title above the box score for this game in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. Trev, we kind of talked about this at the beginning of the podcast, but just again, I'm going to revisit this one more time before we head out. Trev, your feelings on the final day of the regular baseball season. I'm excited when the season starts.
I always am too. It never fails. I'm always excited.
I hit a couple of low points throughout the summer, but by the end of the schedule, these Phillies teams of the past few years have had me ready to go. But there is always that twinge of bittersweet goodbye. It's not just the Phillies season ending. It's the signal that time is pushing onward. The seasons are changing. And can you believe it? Soon there will be more to feel outside than searing heat or suffocating humidity.
I refuse to believe that.
Yeah, that's true. I've seen the forecast. That's
just gonna
romantic, but clearly false.
I don't know why you're saying that, Justin. People are gonna get really upset. They want honesty from you, not this.
Trev, let me rephrase the question. Then it's been another rough year. I want to say probably one of the more heartbreaking Phillies years we've had for a while. Not like a heart snapping or heart popping where it was like one game ended their season. It was just like a slow, steady break.
It felt like one of those. I mean, I know you're a Packers fan, so it might not resonate as well. But it felt like one of those Eagles games where you feel like it's going to fall apart right the whole time, and then instead of it just being in your head, or instead of it being like something ridiculous, like, oh, actually they were fine. They, you know, they pulled it together and then they were okay. Like, don't overreact. It actually just ended up that way. Like, it was just like, yeah, no, they ended up completely losing forever. It just, it was garbage. And, you should feel bad for watching it and getting into it.
There were some really bad losses. The only like memorable win I can really recall is the Bryce Harper Grand Slam
on the Cubs. Yeah, that gave me a bit of hope. In retrospect, shame on you, Bryce Harper.
Yeah, but yeah, it's been it was a tough season.
Yeah, and it really was not a fun one.
I'll be honest, as a fan, I'm disappointed. I'm frustrated. I want to see changes. I know everybody's got reasons to not make the changes people have been talking about. But honestly, I don't see how you go into next year without changing something, because this has not worked 2 years in a row now. And if we got to do another one of these seasons where you have every reason to expect the team to be good and then they just don't show up for the, you know, not the entire last half of the season, but, you know, significant chunks. And again, you know, a lot of this year had to do with luck and injuries.
Yeah.
And you know, they've had pretty much every bad thing a baseball team can suffer in a year. This team had off the field issues, on the field issues, management issues, talent acquisition issues, health issues.
Yeah, no,
bullpen
it was bad.
Issues, offense issues, starting rotation issues. I mean, every kind of issue you can have, they had them. I'm ready to see a good Phillies team again. And maybe that's greedy, because I came up in Philadelphia around the time where there was a series of really good, really likable Phillies teams. And we knew we were spoiled at the time, but it was really tough to feel spoiled when it was happening. You were just like, yeah, this will just go on forever, the way everything currently happening does.
I think it's unfair to say that you're spoiled, because I mean, I think like The one thing I will agree with that the weirdo who was like upset at people having like 100 lost parties or whatever, like the one thing I will agree with that guy is that it does feel like there's too much of an identity around like, well, this team's been terrible forever. Like, yeah, I get that. Like, we do a podcast about that. I know that that's the case, but like, you can't, like, how are you going to have that be your like central identity? Like, how are you going to be like, oh, I shouldn't get greedy. The Phillies are always bad. Like, that's not what you're saying. But like, if you can imagine people saying that, like, how could you, when do you stop feeling that way? Like, when do you start saying like, you know what, actually, like, I like good baseball and I want them to be good. And I don't think that's particularly greedy.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's not, it shouldn't be spoiled to expect your team to be competitive or even likable. I mean, likable is subjective. A good team is, you're going to find a way to like a good team.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, that's exactly right. And I think, like, it, just to say, like, oh, yeah, you know, we haven't had a good team in a row for, you know, ever or whatever. Yeah, okay, fine, but, like, I still would like that. I want that to happen. If that's possible, that'd be great.
I think especially you should always be able to expect your team to put a competitive team on the field. Sometimes you enter a season knowing that's not going to be the case,
yeah.
But you should always expect that they're intending to head in that direction. The Phillies are at a point in their rebuild where we should be expecting better than we got this year.
I agree. And I totally agree.
And in the regular season finale, I'm ready to start expecting that. So let's do a little better, Phillies. I know you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah,
how bad you are.
I know one of them is.
But thank you for listening to our regular season finale episode of The Dirty Inning.
What a joy, Justin. Thank you for being here with me.
What a ride. What another thrill ride. And as Trev said, we will obviously continue this podcast into and through the winter. We hope you subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hitting Season with John Stolness and Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, as well as The Dirty
Inning. I'd encourage you not to listen to those good podcasts after you listen to this one.
Right. Only listen to this one, really. If you're going to listen to this one, like, take a day off.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would agree. Not a great idea.
But thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.
Goodbye.